Blog Talk Radio.
It's almost time.
You right there with the pretzel. Time to sit down.
Cruise, man.
Yeah.
Hey, you going to the concession stand. You going to the bathroom. Come back. The show's about to start.
Got my boys. We out here ready. We about to be some high-flying, high-slamming, slammer-jammer, three-point shooting between the legs, behind your back, through your legs, on your neck. Hey, everybody, you guys will get in your seats. I'm going to sing the national anthem.
Ready.
It's time to... I put down the babies, put down the pepperoni.
Let's go!
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, game time!
Well, family, there's another Parent Coach of Parent Blog Talk Radio Show. I'm your host, M.H. Scott, and, I'm not going to sit here and tell you I'm going to promise you another wonderful show. I'm just going to let you know it's going to be another wonderful show. But, before we get started, I always like to chime in and give my man, Mr. Keith Wright. Keith Wright, a recent graduate of Harvard University, wrote this little piece for the Parents Coach of Parents Network, and I told him I'll play it each and every time I get a chance. Where you at, Keith?
Student of the game, had people front and talk about me, but that ain't no thing. See, I know I would make it with the knowledge in my brain, and if I succeed with that, then B-Ball would do the same. I can't complain, the situation that I'm in, meeting different connects that turn out to be my friend. I know it'll turn out great when my 4 years come to an end, and when the ball starts bouncing on my diploma out the pen, but I'm hating then. Playing ball is just a small part. With this education, I have a great start. And if you work hard for the teachers, they might be showing love in the stands and in the bleachers. I'm only preaching. I'm just trying to spit knowledge and acknowledge opportunities at your disposal when you get to college. I use ball as a tool. Now every day I'm living and I'm making smart moves. That's how I do.
You know, I like to throw that little piece in there each and every time because Keith closes that out with something really powerful and really, impactful for a lot of our young folks. It's okay to make smart cool. It's okay to make smart cool. But, you know, like I was saying earlier, we're going to have another wonderful show. So if you got a chance to get your pen, paper, and pens out and all that other kind of stuff, hey, you better get ready to take some real serious notes because our guest today is going to be somebody I don't have too many words for, you know, because not to say that I just recently met our guest, but, you know, I think I feel as though I've known our guest for a number of years. Our guest today will be Miss Marilyn R. Jones, Esquire. I like the way she puts that. She specializes in NCAA Division I and transfer student eligibility. Miss Jones is an insider. She uses her insider experience gained over the last 2 decades working with 5 universities, and we'll hopefully get a chance to let us know what universities she worked with throughout the years. But she has 2 decades of experience working with 5 universities. She also worked with the Orange Bowl Committee and the Atlanta Committee that put together the Olympic Games. Wow. So she's had some serious experience, and she uses all of that experience and all those relationships to help our parents and our student athletes in being that eligibility coach. So without further ado, we're going to go ahead and bring up our guest, our friend, the eligibility coach, Mrs. Marlon Jones. Ms. Jones, are you with us? Hello.
Hi, I'm here. It's Marlon.
Okay, I was wondering. I thought I had lost you for a second there. I started to get nervous. Hopefully I ain't butcher up your intro too bad, but I like to let folks know that we have an expert out here, so they better be ready.
I appreciate it.
Yes, ma'am. I mentioned something about the 5 different universities, that you've worked at, and you have the experience coming in here with 2 decades of experience. You know, I guess one of my first questions coming right off the bat, and I don't just going to throw it out there, you know, what led you to this field of compliance and, you know, just dealing with the whole eligibility situation?
Well, when I went to work at the NCAA, I was actually in its publishing department, and that was at the time when there was not compliance. There was just enforcement, and what is now called academic and membership affairs was called NCAA legislative affairs. And legislative affairs interpreted rules and regulations for universities and conference offices, and enforcement went in when schools or coaches had broken those rules. And there was an outcry from the membership that they needed something from the NCAA that would help them know how to set up their department so that they could follow all of the rules. And the NCAA established a compliance department back at the national office in the late 80s. From that, there grew positions at each of the conference offices, and from that there then became positions at each of the universities. And now most universities have multi-person departments, especially on the Division I level football, bowl subdivision and football championship subdivision. So when I was there to watch it kind of grow and develop, and by the time I finished law school, there were a lot of different positions that were open, and there was a gentleman I met when he was the athletic director at Arizona State while I was working at the NCAA who had someone leave his conference office. He was the commissioner for the Mid-Eastern Athletic Conference. I was working for the Florida Senate at the time, and he contacted me to see if I would be interested in coming back closer to home. And my mother had just passed, so I was looking to get closer to my dad. And so it worked out that my first position working directly solely with compliance was at the MEAC office working for 11-member institutions.
All right. You know, folks, that just told you a whole lot. That told you we got a true expert on the line with us today. And definitely, if you ain't got your pens and papers out, you need to go ahead and get it. We may give you a second to get it, but if not, we're going to keep on moving. So, some of the things that I like to, do in my spare time, you know, I try to keep all parents informed of, you know, what this process is all about. And this is normally a really tough process. Our guest here today has put together a book, and this book, she has basically identified it as an action guide, you know, and I want to know more about why she identified it as an action guide, because everybody comes out with books from time to time, but, you know, not too many folks identify this book as an action guide. Give us the name of the book and why you identified it as an action guide.
Sure. It's the Athletic Scholarship Eligibility Coach. It's a how-to guide for the eligibility certification game. Parents and student athletes make sure that they know all the rules and all the regulations for the sports they play, but a lot of times they don't spend as much time learning the rules of eligibility and certification. And if you cannot be certified by either the NCAA or the NAIA Eligibility Center, you will not be able to receive an athletic scholarship. It's an action guide because this is not a passive process. This is a process that is going to take a lot of time, it's going to take a lot of research, and it's going to require a system that is in place to track a lot of different information for 3 different processes. And we go through and explain to the parents that they're going through 3 different processes simultaneously, but they have different requirements. There's the graduation process, there's the college admissions process, and there's the certification process. And you have to complete all 3 successfully in order to be able to get a college athletic scholarship. So I just want the parents to know, and the youth coaches who are helping parents and the guidance counselors, that it's going to take some time and some work, but this book hopefully shows you step by step what you need to do from the 9th grade through post graduation.
Okay. Well, you know, it's something that you mentioned a second ago and really caught my attention, how you talked about the three different processes.
Mm-hmm.
And in those three processes, I know there's somebody at each of the high schools that's supposed to or should be able to help you. Does each high school have a person that should help you with anything?
Well, each of the high schools that has registered with the NCAA has an eligibility center contact person, and that is the person that goes in between the high school and the NCAA to make sure that their core course list is updated, that the NCAA knows their grading scale, that they know if they have honors or AP grading scales that are different from the regular grading scale, and they are the person who takes information back from the eligibility center to the student athletes. What happens is some schools have more college-level quality athletes than others, and some only run across a student athlete who can actually participate in college athletics every few years. So some are more up to date on what is happening with eligibility and certification than others.
Okay. Well, you know, one thing that I experienced there, like you said, some schools are more in tune and stay up to date with the information, and some schools are lacking because every now and then they may get a child that actually qualifies. You know, it is so important to me that we as parents of our children, being advocates for our parents, or being advocates for our children, stay involved and stay engaged in this process. What is your thoughts on that there, Ms. Jones?
Well, it is the parents' process, and in conjunction with the student athlete. The high school coaches and the youth coaches have a lot of students that they work with. And the guidance counselors also work with a great number of students. But you only have a finite number of children. And you have the most vested interest in making sure that child gets a scholarship. I kind of look at it, you can make it analogous to a wedding. Your wedding day is the most important day in the world to you. It's another event for everybody else.
Okay, that took it to the extreme. Analogy, reference to a wedding. Okay, that's so true. That's so true. I agree with you on that. If you want to put it at that level, you know, along with those with the wedding, you also sit down and you take your vows, and then you have your wedding, your marriage license, and things like that. And both of you should fully understand those marriage license. But along with being a student athlete and trying to prepare for college and receiving that initial offer, you have something that is called your National Letter of Intent. You know,
correct.
And how important is that document to our students and as well as our parents?
Well, the first thing parents have to realize is that the National Letter of Intent is a legal contract, and that is why parents for children who are under 21 years of age must sign the document as well. It is a contract that binds the student athlete, once they sign it, to attend that university for one full academic year. And that is regardless of coaching changes or anything else that may happen at that university. Now, the university is also bound to provide a scholarship for that student for 1 year. But if that student is not admitted to the school or if they're not certified by the eligibility center, the contract becomes null and void. And that's why it's so important for parents to understand exactly what it is they're signing. The NLI by itself is not valid unless it's accompanied by a grant in aid. And that's the document that's going to explain exactly how much money the school is offering, and that's where parents need to make sure they understand what their financial investment is going to have to be.
You know, you've loaded us up with some information so far, and I think we're getting to the point where I got some folks here on the line, and look like a few folks may even have some questions or want to chime in on something. If you have any questions, give us a call at 646-929-2416. 646-929-2416. I think we got a caller on the line, and this caller may have a question.
Okay.
Good afternoon, caller. You're on the line with the Parents Coach and Parents Network. How can we help? Hello? Caller, area code 757, last four, 755.
Last that's me.
Yes, sir. How can
we
help?
Doing? Hey, Mike, how you doing? It's Coach Porter, Seven Cities Elite. I have a question for what
Mr. Jones?
Are you? Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
We can hear you.
Okay, I have a question. What is your take on the NCAA with kids that's reclassifying?
Do you mean students who are going to repeat a year of high school for whatever reason?
Yes.
Yes. Well, what happens regardless of how many years a student takes to graduate from high school? Compliance officers are only allowed to count courses completed in the first 8 semesters. So you need to make sure that if you're repeating any courses, trying to raise your grade point average, or if you're trying to replace courses, say you got a D in a U.S. history and you want to take a world history and you made a B, you're going to have to make sure that all of those courses are completed within the first 8 semesters. Now, they do allow students to complete one course after high school graduation and before they enroll in college to meet the 16 core course requirements. The only other exception is for students who have documented learning disabilities, and they're allowed to complete up to 3 courses after high school graduation. But other than that, you need to get those 16 core courses completed within the first 8 semesters.
Okay, sounds good. Now, wouldn't that kind of deter an athlete if they're average, if they did that, if they repeated? Is there a new rule concerning that?
Well,
they wouldn't be eligible to play?
No, it is up to that family. If that student wants to go to a prep school, if they just want to do another year of high school, if they're trying to get older, bigger, and stronger. But what they have to understand, again, we're doing 3 different things. You're trying to graduate from high school because you must be a high school graduate. You're also trying to get admitted to the college of your choice. And depending on what university you're interested in attending, there may be some additional requirements you didn't meet during those first 4 years that you have to meet before you can be admitted. But what I focus on is strictly certification. And in order for the NCAA or the NAIA to be able to certify you to receive a scholarship that you've been offered, you're going to have to complete those courses with your high school class.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that information.
Sure.
I'm going to let my parents know on my AAU team. Hey, Mike. It's Coach
yes,
Corey,
sir.
Man.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, thanks for sending me this number, man. I'm loving this conversation here.
No problem. You can catch us every Wednesday at 12 noon. We got something good going on every Wednesday regardless.
I see, Mr. Scott. I see.
All right. Stay online and listen to the rest of the information.
Yes, sir, definitely.
All right.
Good talking to you. Thank you.
Okay.
Sure, thank you.
All right.
Well, Ms. Jones, we're going to pause for a half a second here, and then we're going to come back and finish up with some questions, and hopefully we may even have some more calls and some more questions for you. But we're just going to pause for a moment just to give you a chance to take a little quick break. We'll be right back.
For college sports, winning has its price. Coach turned lawyer turned author explores the corruption behind collegiate sports. Cold-blooded murder, drug habits, laundering, extortion, and witness tampering. No, this isn't a laundry list of the Mafia's chosen pastimes. This is a collection of known scandals in collegiate sports. Look at the recent NCAA investigations from USC all the way to UConn and UNC. Consider the regrettable Baylor University scandal in 2003, which left one young player murdered and an immoral coach exposed. The Arizona State University point-shaving scheme in the 90s, the 1999 University of Minnesota men's basketball academic cheating scandal, and even the recent Rick Pitino extortion case are perfect examples of an innocent American pastime gone wrong. We'll talk to the author of the great novel Dismissed with Prejudice on the Parents Coaching Parents Network. So log on Thursday at 9 p.m. Check out Parents Coaching Parents Network on blogtalkradio.com/parentscoachingparents.
Well, folks, we've been on talking for the last 20 minutes or so, and hopefully we're going to go for a little while longer talking with Ms. Marlon Jones, Esquire, compliance specialist, or should I say compliance expert connected to that Parents Coaching Parents Network. And she's been sharing some good information with us. And matter of fact, she just answered some phenomenal questions for one of our coaches that called in. But, you know, she mentioned something a second ago that I want to hear her elaborate a little bit more on. She mentioned something about disability and learning disabilities. Because oftentimes our children miss that opportunity, and don't document that information correctly. So as a result, they miss out on that extra opportunity that they have. If Ms. Jones, if you're still on the line with us, share a little information on that learning disability issue that you talked about there.
Sure. What the problem that we found at the campus level is that there are students who received accommodations in high school, and they don't want their coaches to know. They want to try to make it on their own in college. And they end up coming to either see the compliance officer or the athletic academic advisor after they've already failed courses. It is really in the best interest of everyone. If a student has an IEP in place, if they've ever been diagnosed with a disability, if they've ever received any accommodations in high school, whether it's a note taker, extended time on tests, a quiet place to take tests, if they register with the University Disability Services Office as soon as they arrive on campus, and they let the compliance office and the athletic academic advisor know, the three offices can work together to make sure that that student can have accommodations in place from the first day they start college so that they can get off on a good foot and with a good grade point average. Because it's much easier to graduate if you start out at least average than if you start out below average trying to pull back up. But the problem that we have had is getting persons to submit that documentation to us. And it must come from the physician or the high school where the student was tested. All of that information needs to go to the NCAA Eligibility Center so that they can go through it, recognize it. And I even had one student just within the last month who had 14 core courses, was going to take the last two core courses in the summer. But since he had over a 3-4 grade point average in high school, and the only two courses he was missing were electives, they were able to waive that for him so that he didn't have to take the other courses.
Wow. Okay. I guess the NCAA, when they decide to work with you, they decide to work with you and make all things possible. That's great information. And the reason why I say that, because I've known the number of young men that have missed out on opportunities because they decided to take that route and they didn't want to let their coaches know and they wanted to try to do it all by themselves, not realizing that how much support the institution is going to give you if they know that you had that IEP,
That's correct.
And to be there for you, and you get you just don't know the amount of support that the academic department will provide you, tutoring and everything else, to make sure that you get through, help, one-on-one, not no just massive tutoring where you go sit in the study hall and whatever. You get one-on-one assistance, you know, if it's identified. Go ahead, Marilyn.
Just the NCAA mandates that every athletic department provide academic support services for the student athletes. And the university generally also has support services in place for all students. And student athletes are students at that university. So you're actually able to receive support services from two different places.
Run that by me one more time. Because I thought I heard something else that caught my attention.
Okay. The student athlete is able to use all of the services in place that the athletic department provides its student athletes. But that person is a student of the university first. And
yes.
So all of the services that are provided to just general students at the university are available to them as well. So they're available to get services from two different places on campus.
Well, you know, a lot of times I think our parents and student athletes alike miss out on that part, not realizing that they have to be accepted into that university.
That's correct.
You know, that's not part of the process that registers in their head as far as them being accepted to that university. Okay, you could be the best ball player, you can run the best routes, you can, you know, average 3 goals a game or whatever the case may be. But if you're not accepted to that university based upon the criteria that they have, then you're still sitting outside trying to get in.
And that's one of the things I did in the book. I used information from College Board and from different university websites and compiled a chart which has NCAA Division I and II schools and NAIA Division I and II schools. And it lists their mean SAT and ACT scores as well as their median high school grade point average and the percentage of students that they accept each year. So that parents and students can go through the schools that they're interested in and see how their individual academic profile stacks up against the profile of persons who have been admitted to that university recently.
And one other thing that she has in this phenomenal book that I recommend all parents get a copy of, and coaches as well get a copy of this phenomenal book, Eligibility Coach. You know, she has a breakdown of the recruiting budget. Well, I like to look at it as a recruiting budget. You know, give us a little insight on how you put this information together and what parents really don't know about that recruiting budget. Because oftentimes I talk to parents about just a piece of, you know, when your child's going to school, make sure he's going to a school that has a budget that can travel to and from. But I never really thought about the recruiting budget and how that plays a bigger part into your child being recruited.
Well, I looked at two different charts that go with that admissions piece, the recruiting one that you're speaking of, and also the scholarship one, because what a lot of people do in their research is they see how many scholarships a school can offer, and those are maximums. So while in the sport of volleyball, for example, the most number of scholarships you can offer at Division I is 12, every school is not fully funded to 12. So if you look at the scholarship budget, you can see how many students they're actually financing. Now, in order to be recognized by a school, the coach has got to know about you. And that's where you have to do your own personal marketing to let people know that your student athlete is out there. Unless they're one of the top students is being recruited by everybody in the country, you're going to have to work on developing a marketing and recruiting plan. And by using our chart on recruiting budgets, you can see how much that university actually spent for recruiting male student athletes and recruiting female student athletes. Again, it's broken down by NCAA Division I and II and NAIA Division I and II. So if the school that you're most interested in only had a $20,000 recruiting budget
for male student athletes last year, you know that you're probably going to have to do a lot of self-promotion just to get on their radar, because that amount of money is not going to allow them to get all over the country to see every travel ball team, much less high school competition.
You know, I stress that same point to parents all the time. You know, if your child is at, say, for example, a school in Virginia Beach, Virginia, that's
okay.
Just one school out of the 10 high schools that's in that particular city. What about
exactly.
All the other 7 cities that's connected to your area? Each one of them have a multiple number of schools. What about the whole entire state of Virginia? So coaches are not going to just try to pinpoint one trip to one high school just to see one kid. You know, they like to see – go ahead.
And that's why coaches, the college coaches have gone to going to more of the tournaments and the travel ball tournament events, because they can see 200 to 1,000 kids at one time, as opposed to going to one high school basketball game where they may see at most.
Exactly. And I tell parents all the time, you got to know the recruiting calendar. You got to know when coaches are able to be out there to even watch your game or watch
exactly.
your particular event. You know, because if you're going out in June knowing that that is a dead period or a quiet period, you may not have anybody out there to observe you. So as a result, you're out there, you're performing, it may be your best turnout. But it's all done for what reason at the end of the day?
You've got to get the exposure. You've got
exactly.
to get the exposure. And that's one of the other common mistakes that parents make, is they have their students calling coaches, or they call coaches themselves, and they don't receive a return phone call, and so they take it that the coach is not interested, when it may be a time in the recruiting calendar, or based on the student athlete's year in school, that the coach is not allowed to call the student back. And that's another thing we do in the book, is go through the top 21 mistakes that parents make and try to explain them so that they'll know how to avoid them. And that I run into a lot.
And you said that right on time, because I want to give us a quick highlight on some of those 21 mistakes, but I want to do a follow-up show just with those top 21 mistakes. If you can give
okay.
us a quick highlight on them. And then we're going to move on.
Well, I would say the one that I find that causes the most problems is just not understanding about what the NCAA grade point average is. Students and parents think that the NCAA uses the grade point average on their high school transcript, and that just is not true. Since the NCAA requires 16 core courses for both Division I and Division II, they are different 16 courses, but there's still 16 core courses required by each. They only use the grades received in those 16 courses. And when you start with the wrong GPA, looking at a sliding scale, you think you need a different standardized test score than you actually need. So you'll think that you're actually certified when you're not, because you're using the wrong numbers on the scale. And I think
yes.
I probably run into that problem more than any other, trying to explain to a parent that, yes, I know this transcript says you have a 2.6 grade point average, but I had one student that was really in love with music. He took 11 music courses in high school. We couldn't count any of them. When we took those 11 music courses out, the 2.6 GPA dropped to a 2.1.
Well, you know, that's interesting that you mentioned that, not being able to use any of those music courses. You know, parents, it's important that you know what's on that core course list. If you don't know what's on that core course list, I highly recommend that you either reach out to our eligibility coach. I'm going to book you. I'm going to claim you ourselves for the Parents
okay.
Coach Parent Network. This is our own personal eligibility coach.
That's not a problem.
Glad to
serve.
Yes. Reach out to us here at the Parents Coach Parents Network, and we can provide you with that information or show you how to get to that information, because you have to know what's on the core course list. You know, when you run into, go ahead.
That's another one of the top mistakes, is that people register for their high school courses semester after semester without consulting their high school's list. Just like you were saying, each person has an eligibility center contact. Each school that is registered with the NCAA has a published list of courses that the NCAA has approved. And you need to make sure before you register every semester that you're consulting that list and taking courses that are on that list. Because even though it may be an academic course, I had a student recently who had 15 core courses. They were one short. They took physics. Physics is an academic course, but their high school hadn't updated the list to include that physics course. So until the high school did that, we and the NCAA could not count that physics course, and that student was then short one core course from being able to be certified.
Yes, that hit the nail right on top of the head, because I've seen situations where individual young man had took, he was coming from another school, he had took U.S. government. Well, that was the name of the course. That was the name
mm-hmm.
of the syllabus that was put together. And when he transferred, that course was not listed on his new school's, And as a result, he got over there and come to find out the course was the same exact course as U.S. government as they had listed. Different designated number. The syllabus was basically mirror each other, maybe one or two little changes or whatever, but they basically mirrored each other as far as the information that was being provided to the students. So that is
so he
so
had
important.
The same course twice.
He had the same course twice, exactly. And he ended up taking the same course twice because of the fact that it wasn't listed the first time at the first school he was at. So he ended up taking it again without knowing that, okay, you're about to take the same class over. So, you know, being aware of what's on that core course list and checking with your NCAA coordinator, if there's one at your school, is so important, so important. Well, Ms. Jones, give us something on how to reach you, how to contact you, and
sure.
a little bit more insight on the book.
Sure. My email address is mjones@eligibilitycoach.com. My telephone number is 919-408-7431. Again, it's 919-408-7431. The book has its own website, which is www.eligibilitycoach.webs.com. I write a blog, which generally we average about 2 posts a week. We answer parents' questions and just provide information, tips on what's going on with NCAA and NAIA eligibility certification. And the blog is www.eligibilitycoach.com. You can also purchase the book at www.eligibilitycoach.com/buy-the-book. Or you can visit Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. And the name of the book, again, is The Athletic Scholarship Eligibility Coach, a how-to guide for the eligibility certification game.
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. And I'm telling you, folks, it's information out there that, and it's an easy read. I've skimmed through it real quick and seen some of the things that jump out at me. And her format, I got to commend you on that format. She has pregame information in there. She has first half information in there. She has halftime information in there. She has second half information and postgame information in there as well. The only thing she didn't break it down by quarters, but she gave it to us by the halves. So I definitely have some information in there.
And I forgot to mention, we also have quick 2-minute tips on our YouTube channel. at www.youtube.com/eligibilitycoach. And that just answers briefly some quick questions, some of the most frequently asked questions that come up time and time again from parents.
Well, actually, folks, if you want to really, really stay in touch with what she's doing, she also got a little Twitter page out there as well.
Yes.
And that's at Eligibility,
Coach, but without the last H.
Without
the last
H.
Twitter only gives you, Twitter only gives you so many characters, and we had one character too many.
Okay, there. That's right, Eligibility Coach minus the last H. So follow her on Twitter as well, as well as following us at PCP Network. And we'll be staying in touch and staying in tune and keeping up with all the wonderful things that Ms. Jones is doing out there. And hopefully we can get her here in our area. We'll definitely have her on the show again. And
I would love to come up and do a workshop for the parents. One of the things we do is a hands-on workshop where we have the parents bring the actual transcripts, the students' actual transcripts, and we go through, one, how to find the core course list and check the names and make sure that the names are matching so that they know what conversations they need to have with the guidance counselor. And then we also go through and show you how to calculate your NCAA GPA, how to use the sliding scale, how to determine if you need to take the SAT or the ACT over. We go through all of that in a couple of hours.
Very good, very good. Outstanding information available to you. You know, you mentioned something about the SAT and the ACT, and we talked briefly about that this afternoon. You know, one of the questions that a lot of parents miss out on, I think they miss out on, is how many times can they take the SAT? You know, how many times do they want to take that test?
You can take the SAT as many times as you wish. Now the ACT limits you to 12. So there is a difference between the two. The ACT limits you to 12, but the SAT does not have a limit. It is in your best bet, your best case scenario, to start taking that test around the 7th or 8th grade, so that by the time your student is in the 10th or the 11th grade, they're comfortable with the format, they're comfortable with the timing, they're comfortable with bubbling in the answers, and they can get a higher score. The other thing is parents invest in equipment, and they invest in hotels and food for travel ball and for tournaments. You need to invest in a course that is going to prepare you for the SAT or the ACT, because a lot of times it's that test score that's going to determine whether or not you're going to be able to get the scholarship.
Yes.
And for parents who have students that are in the high school class of 2016, those are current freshmen, they're going to be subject to a new NCAA sliding scale. And on every step of the scale for your grade point average, the SAT required score is 180 points higher than the current scale.
Okay. Well, we're going to start to wind down. I want to see if Coach Corey has anything to ask. It looks like he has a light on here to if he wants to chime in or had another question. You still out there, sir?
Yes, I'm here.
Did you have another question?
Yeah, she basically just answered it for me.
Okay.
Because we were concerned when our son should start looking into taking those tests. And do you recommend Ms. Jones that, because I have an eighth grade AAU team, do you recommend that those kids start now taking prep classes as well for the SATs for the future, take those prep classes? Because I was told that Kaplan had a course that they offered.
They do. There are lots of different companies that offer courses. Kaplan's probably the most widely known because they do everything from SAT prep to med school prep to law school prep. But there are some other local companies that also have courses. some churches and some universities offer courses. So you just need to look around and see what's available in your area. But it's almost pointless to take the test two or three different times if you're not going to change how you prepare for it.
Exactly. And I recommend, you know, folks taking that test, you know, two, three, four, five times or whatever, give you a better feel for it. And then you learn the testing strategies. There's a young man here in our area, Corey, that actually